What's up and welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. Today I have back on the podcast Dr. Anastasia Carclina-Gabrielle, who's Senior Insights Lead at Reddit, but we're here today to talk about Dr. Gabrielle's brand new book, Cultural Intelligence for Marketers, subtitled Building an Inclusive Marketing Strategy. I read in advance of this. It's published through Kogan Page. We're going to talk about writing a book, marketing a book, and we'll obviously talk about the content in the book. But Dr. Gabrielle, how comfortable are you talking to non-academics?
It's a learning curve, but I believe very strongly in the value of other kinds of knowledge other than business in the world of business. And so part of the project in the book or the book's aspiration is to bring some of that knowledge to the world of business and make it as legible, as accessible as it possibly could.
Sometimes when I see your name in my DMs or email, my initial reaction, not sometimes, every time, my initial reaction is, what did I do now? Am I getting canceled? And is this the time where I just have to move to the middle of nowhere? Is that because I'm a fragile white man?
I would say part of my delivery and part of my own role in the world of business is that of an agitator. So I recognize that that's my style and that's part of what I believe is important in the kind of work that we do, you know, pushing the needle, pushing the boundary forward. And a lot of times that means that we're going to be uncomfortable, you know, in the world of business as a whole is just not always used to having the kind of conversations that are pretty standard in the world that I come from, which is academia and grassroots activism, where folks, you know, are living and breathing the kind of questions of identity, oppression, marginalization, and so on. So I would love to think that some of that anxiety is productive in the end and is making it more comfortable to us for us to be uncomfortable.
Also, like you, way I've seen you express yourself online, is it right to say more or less, not in an academic right way, but in a generally speaking right kind of way, that at the heart of your intellectual fire is that you identify as being an activist?
I like that you use the word intellectual fire because I was trained in Black studies and Black feminist studies, as you might recall from our previous conversation. And part of what I think about is this concept of Black prophetic fire, which is a concept coined by Dr. Cornel West. And obviously, I'm not Black myself, but I have been trained in that tradition and in that body of intellectual, political, and activist knowledge. So I do really think of myself as an activist, an agitator, and disruptor, and see that as my mission in the kind of work that I do now, precisely because I think that is what our industry and our profession needs, not only from the point of inclusivity and social responsibility, which, as you know, I care deeply about, but from the point of creativity and from the point of moving forward with culture and staying ahead of where culture is moving. And as I often say, it's just impossible for us to separate ourselves from these questions, from the questions of activism, which is really to say, from the questions of social progress.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like with the last two questions, you're creating distance from my question, which I find interesting. I'm either going to meet you on the bridge or I'm going to pull you over to my side at some point. This might be reaching too far. It's not a personal critique or commentary. I'm just using it to like annoy you a little bit to see what can happen. Mostly because I thought I was getting canceled every time I saw your name in my emails and DMs for a very, very long time.
And here we are, Mark, and that's a testament.
I'm not fragile. Why are you making it about you, white guy? I know. Have you seen this meme, the soft guy era?
I have not seen it, but I have seen it something on your Instagram this morning that I didn't get to look into it closely. So fill me in.
Okay. So maybe I should have sent it to you ahead of time because I'm really curious on your take. So the way that I understand this meme, which is it's hilarious if you just look at things comedically, right? Which I get nervous about when I'm talking to an academic who might do that, but might also not do that, is it's these two Black American guys. Let me mention their name. I have their names here. Scarface Mark and Little Goody started to create these posts where they would talk about entering their soft guy era. It's a response to the soft girl era. And I think specifically it builds on a construct of storytelling, which doesn't necessarily originate with one person, but I think a lot of people point to a particular video by a YouTuber called Letitia Padua, where she's talking about not settling for broke men and how she has all these expectations, and she mentions what can seem like to some people a crazy expectation, and say sprinkle, sprinkle, as in, you know, God bless your heart, which is a southern thing in the US for way to say something nice when you're actually being mean. Instead of sprinkle, sprinkle, these guys are saying drizzle, drizzle. And I think it's really interesting culturally, right? So the guys will say, you know, I'm a king. I deserve to get taken care of. I just decided to not go on a date with this woman because she turned up in a 2012 Honda to drive me to the restaurant. And then their requests and demands become more and more absurd. As a piece of comedy, it's hilarious. But it does hit this moment in time. And also I want to acknowledge that I believe where this has come from is essentially three black creators. So I was curious about your take on that, but let's get to that in a second. But it's coming at a time where we're seeing a lot of research about divisions in gender, where young men are becoming quote unquote more conservative. Young women have becoming more and more progressive. Lots of reasons for it all. Lots of speculation, everything from like the alpha male content and the algorithms through to women wanting human rights, for example. I'm going to leave it there. So I don't know if that's enough information for you to help me understand it. I'm kind of like interested in your personal and academic reaction. Maybe they're the same thing.
They couldn't be the same thing because we have to talk about power and we have to talk about, when we talk about culture, we have to talk about power relations and the history of how groups interact with each other and how no one in particular, but historically, men have oppressed women, as well as, you know, this idea, or I guess the larger force of what we might call white patriarchy in my field of studies has been an oppressive force for women, but also people who are marginalized by gender in other ways. So we could think of non-binary people, queer people, anyone who exists outside of the confines of patriarchal heteronormative expectations. So it's an interesting, you know, without having seen it, my mind goes to the kind of interesting tension within there, because actually the sprinkle sprinkle, as I know it in the world of social media, refers to this YouTube creator whose name I'm blanking on, who talks about essentially taking advantage of men's financial resources and essentially demanding to be treated at a particular standard, right? So then you see women commenting, mostly on TikTok is where I see it, sprinkle, sprinkle, because that's what the YouTube creator who encourages young women to accept nothing less than what they deserve, you know, she says sprinkle, sprinkle. And so thinking about the reverse of that, I guess, what did you say? There was a soft guy era. It's interesting to think about that as a reaction from men in a kind of effort to create some kind of equality. Well, if you ask me that, I'm going to ask you that. If you demand something of me, I'm going to do the same. And I do, in this case, will think that that comes out of a sense of fragility and a sense of being threatened. One's power position in society being threatened. Because in order to actually accept that women in our point in culture demanding certain things that they structurally have been prohibited from or don't have the same privilege and don't have the same access to engage with that would actually mean to acknowledge one's position of power and privilege in society. And when we don't want to do that, then in my reading, in my interpretation, the soft guy era emerges as a response to that.
Yeah. And it's comedic, although satirical. So some people took it seriously. But yeah, there's been a spate of videos that these videos sometimes mock where there'll be some, you know, I know I'm talking about heteronormative, et cetera, situations, but, you know, a lady's putting on makeup and she's like, here's why I managed to spend $200 on a first date with me. And, you know, she's calculating the cost of the makeup that she's putting on. I think it's like interesting to me comedically and satirically.
Well, satire draws on the world around us. Satire is a critique, and satire is a reflection, a comedic reflection or commentary on what we are observing around us. So, you know, it's both a comedic genre and a commentary of what's actually really happening in the world, right? Where we can go into the conversations online around gender dynamics and actually see men responding, you know, in a pretty serious way. So it's an interesting, how that's something that we both can laugh on, but then to the point of the research that you mentioned, we also are seeing that in the data where, you know, men are becoming more conservative. And I would interpret that as being more hostile to certain ideas around women's empowerment. And how is that, that is manifesting in culture right now?
Yeah. So just the last thing on this, I wasn't sure how to sort of steward a conversation because you're way more educated and have way more tools than I do to analyze something like this. What's within the satire from one camp, and it is a camp, one camp's point of view, is that there's a group of people who are saying they want equality, but then they make outlandish claims that if another group requested would be seen as being outlandish. So it's not really a seeking out equality, it's seeking equality. It's hiding behind the idea of seeking equality, but they're actually seeking superiority, right? So I think that's one camp's. You know, you haven't said whether that's valid or not, but you're saying, well, first we have to look at the long-term patterns, who's had power and who's been marginalized, etc. What question would you ask yourself about this right now if you weren't a doctor, but you're interviewing one about this topic?
I would ask, how do we define equality and what are the different ways to understand what equality actually means? So I would be curious to have a conversation about that, because as you talk, what comes to mind is, well, that might be one interpretation of equality where all of us are completely equal and have the same in culture and society, we should have the same rights, but right, but that we have the same relationship to equality, right? Let me try to break it down. We can take the concept of equality and we can interpret it as, okay, well, now we're going to be equal and all of us should exact the same relationship to equality. So we should have access to the same thing. We should understand equality as the same thing. And so what that actually leads me to question is like, who is defining how we are understanding equality? Because I was just in the comments of Professor Galloway, who was critiquing diversity, equity, inclusion. And perhaps this is related to this conversation where his critique was that, say, Black student organization or Latino student organization are creating segregation. This is not necessarily related to the gender question, but in some ways it is, because my response to him was, you are looking at it through the lens of whiteness, because white people have historically used racially exclusive group to segregate and to diminish and to isolate. You are looking at these groups that are uniting people by race and ethnicity as doing the same. But actually, that sort of gathering a community of people who look like you, for them, means completely different, right? So for white people gathering together, that's segregation, that's supremacy. Black people, people of color gathering together, that's empowerment because it's responding to that. And so if we connect that to the conversation we're having around these gender conversations and the gender discourse, are women engaging in exactly the same kind of oppression or supremacy as men have historically? Or are women responding to histories of patriarchal oppression by defining equality and empowerment in their own way, by responding to centuries, decades of being socially, politically, and economically oppressed? So who is defining what equality is, what segregation is, what empowerment is, what belonging is?
Your book, Cultural Intelligence for Marketers, I think it's a really important book. I don't say compliments much. I'm not super expressive or reactive, but I think it's a really important book. And I was curious to see the tone of it, not tone policing. I was curious to see the tone and the level of activism and information and useful tools that a practitioner could potentially use. And my reaction, having read an advanced copy, was I think a lot of people who struggled, like I am right now, to find the exact words to talk about some of these topics, but who would also feel marginalized and happen to be working in marketing and advertising, I think this is going to become not necessarily like their Bible, but it's going to be a book that they will see themselves in, that will give them tools to build a career on for quite a long time. Is that something that you were thinking about trying to achieve as you got the book together?
Definitely. And let me try to close the distance that you pointed out earlier in our conversation, which is that that's something I really wanted. That's something that I'm quite nervous about achieving and being able to achieve. I feel very passionate about what this knowledge can do in marketing. And I'm also very aware that that's not a conversation that we have. And in marketing and advertising, we don't really have shared terminology around these things. So when I was writing the book, part of me was really trying to convey the concepts that I think really matter for marketing and advertising, like truly, really matter, not just as a way of like shoving down activists or anti-oppressive concepts down people's throats, but that actually can help us do work better. And so as I was writing, I was really trying to focus on activities, checklists, like showing the applicability of this knowledge. And I'm pleased to hear that you think that I might have done half decent job at that. And so that certainly has been my aim, or why I really entered advertising and marketing in the first place, to apply that knowledge in this space.
I think you're selling a lot of copies, possibly a bestseller, although the definitions of bestsellers authors like to be a little bit creative with these days. You go into a little bit about the history of advertising in the US. Is that something that you spent a lot of time studying? Like how big a part of your studies was advertising in the US and its role in the creation of identity and how it interacted often with certain groups of people?
In my studies, I didn't look at advertising specifically, but I've always been very interested in pop culture and entertainment and mass media, which is actually why I left academy. I was really interested in studying things that they were happening in real time. And, you know, when you're academic and you're trying to land a tenure track position and become a professor, you're usually rewarded for studying the canon, which means looking back at history. So advertising was not on my radar per se. If you had told me 5, 6, 7 years ago that I would be doing what I do now, I would like laugh in your face hysterically because it was just so out of this world as an idea for me. But I did study how ideas are reflected in media and culture. And so as I wrote about the history of advertising, it's not something that is directly taken from my doctoral research, but it was easy to accomplish and pull out those threads because advertising is so deeply embedded in culture. So whatever was happening in society in 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, it was a no-brainer, would affect advertising. And so I felt really passionate about teasing out those stories and those instances, because I don't really think in advertising we look back quite often enough.
Is there one story or one epiphany you had when doing the research and writing the book specifically about the history of advertising in the US and how it interacted with people without power? Is there one story or epiphany that you think people right now would benefit the most from? Like, what's the most instructive epiphany or story from the 60s and 70s when it comes to advertising and how it's affecting what we're all doing now?
I do have a story, and it really came to me when I was writing the introduction and I wanted to create that historical context to help advertisers see that questions of inclusivity, purpose, belonging in advertising are, you know, stretching decades. And I was able to get in touch with professor of marketing at UCLA Anderson School of Business. And he was one of the first people, marketing scholars, who wrote about Black representation in advertising and published a study about it in 1969. And as I went into the rabbit hole of researching his work and people he was in conversation with, I found articles, journal articles that were published in 1965 when a scholar was writing about what was happening in advertising at that moment. And if I'm not mistaken, his name is William Boynton. And he wrote that advertising is seeing an evolution, a fourth force that is attacking advertisers beyond the three forces that he defines, which is finding people who are ready to buy, producing advertising that works, and using mass media to reach them. He says there's a fourth force on the horizon. And when I read that, it was like an epiphany for me, because what does he call it? He calls it purpose. He calls it social purpose. And it was just such a visceral experience to read that in 1965 and to recognize that the conversation that we're having now, particularly since 2020, is not the beginning of anything. It's just a culmination of a conversation that has been part of advertising, primarily on the margins, since at least the 60s. And now we're just seeing it pushed to the mainstream where we can no longer ignore it.
So two questions. How do you define brand purpose? And I know it can feel like an old topic for people who've been around the scene for a while and might roll their eyes at that phrase these days, but how do you define social purpose or brand purpose? And I know you don't like being reduced to corporate binaries, so I'm not going to say why should a brand use it, but it's kind of what I want to ask you. So let's define it first, and then I'll try to clarify my second question. Social purpose, brand purpose, how do you define it?
Well, first of all, I define social purpose as much more specific than the broader topic of inclusive marketing. And what I find is that oftentimes those are collapsed. Brands' engagement with any social issues, with any issues of representation, we just label purpose. You know, I think social purpose, as I see it in the world of brands, is a specific social mission that is ingrained and attached to brands' positioning and brands' reason to exist. A lot of brands, as I say, are not going to be purpose-driven brands. And, you know, I'm one of the people who feels passionate about not forcing purpose on brands for purpose's sake. It's not meaningful, not commercially advantageous, and not socially impactful. So I see brand purpose as a very specific element of the brand ecosystem and brand's positioning and how brand goes to market.
Sometimes people get tripped up on brand purpose because it feels like lipstick, whereas there's a philosophical point of view that people might grab onto, which is like businesses shouldn't just be greedy, extracting value from people in the world, often in an unfair way. But that also, there's a bit of research around how businesses with purpose at their heart can attract good employees, good talent, for example. But sometimes I think the word brand in front of the word purpose trips people up, you know, because they're thinking of advertising that's performative, and if performative in how noble it is, but disconnected from the reality that maybe that business doesn't pay taxes.
Yes. And that's a layered question, you know, and we look at purpose-driven brands that actually have quite a lot of unethical practices along their, you know, supply chain, along their labor practices, et cetera. That's the can of worms that I don't even know that we have truly unpacked or opened yet in the world of marketing and advertising. But to my earlier point, I suppose I feel strongly about defining social purpose in the world of business as very much attached to brand's role in the world of commerce and how that intersects with culture. And then I like to think about the brand's broader social responsibility in regards to producing inclusive, representative media. So that means producing creative that is reflective of the audience that we serve, that is counter-stereotypical and conscious about that, that is concerned with producing mass media that is not sexist, racist, classist, all the ists that we could imagine, which has been the history of advertising. So I really find it important to draw that distinction between what we're seeing now and what really concerns me is that there is a kind of collapsing of both the business's social purpose and corporate responsibility and any intention to be more inclusive and culturally fluent into this one big bucket of purpose that we are supposed to leave behind because, you know, clearly it's meaningless. And I just don't like one-sided stories that don't tell the full picture.
You created this framework. It's called the 4 C's of cultural intelligence. I just want you to talk me through it. I like how you've copyrighted this 2023. I've never been bold enough to do that sort of stuff. Reproduction or use without permission is prohibited. Can we reproduce it verbally right now, Doctor?
I created the 4 C's framework because there's desire from marketers to have more practical frameworks for thinking about, well, how do you apply these concepts that I talk about of culture, representation, ideology, et cetera. And so I broke it down in 4 parts, which is culture, communication, consciousness, and community. And while there is a desire in us often to have like a 4-step process, this work is not really straightforward. And I try to create this framework that anyone who's engaged in marketing and advertising can pick up the book and select the parts that relate to their work. So culture really talks about understanding what's happening in culture. How do we analyze and pick up on emergent trends? What is the role that brands play and how brands signify meaning in culture and why that is important for us to understand? And then communications really goes into, well, if brands do signify meaning in culture, that means that any form of representation, any creative, any form of mass media that we put out into the world is going to be interpreted by people. And essentially, I am interested in helping marketers prepare for different kinds of interpretations of their work and specifically unintended anticipations in order to address issues of cultural sensitivity, appropriation, and backlash. And then consciousness really tries to embed the point that I made earlier, which is whether you're a purpose-driven brand or not, social consciousness should be part of any marketer's consideration and our toolkit precisely because we are tasked with producing mass media and it's our responsibility to ensure that that media is inclusive and representative and responsible, whether we're marketing Dove's new campaign around AI and beauty, or if we're marketing mayonnaise that you put on your sandwich, right? It's still part of professional responsibility. And community is really speaking to what I see emerging on the horizon, which is interest from consumers to see brands not just talk the talk, but walk the talk and stop appropriating cultural knowledges and actually engage consumers in a kind of more co-creative capacity, which I already see quite a few brands doing, like Hinge and Lyft. Some of the examples that are top of mind that are bringing consumers into the process.
Let's talk about those two in a second. So you've got communication, community, consciousness outside of a circle, and then there's a triangle in the circle with the word culture. And I take it you could use these 4 C's to report on what you're currently doing as a brand, like how are we currently interacting with cultural communities, etc., but also maybe as like a strategic recommendation, what we should do, what we need to do, right? And then I don't mean this in a flippant way, but in how many ways did you think about drawing this diagram? Because you have a triangle in a circle.
Partially because in the past you have shared, I believe, the four, six C's, model, where conscious inclusion is a kind of six add-on. And I was really interested in producing a framework that places culture at the center, because to me, you cannot have a cultural intelligence strategy related to community and co-creation, how brands engage with their customers or how they convey messages. So communication, how they send out messages into the market without understanding what's happening in culture. And so that is why culture is at the center of this model, because understanding cultural landscape and the zeitgeist we're in and where culture is headed should be informing all other three. But of course, through the iteration and the writing process, it was, you know, the traditional four C's kind of existing on their own. It was an overlap of circles and Venn diagrams and what have you. And so this is the best visual representation that I could have come up with to really communicate that centrality of culture in our work.
There's a book called The Lords of Strategy, and it looks at the history of management consultancies. And literally what they would do in the 60s and 70s is draw a diagram and sell it for 10 years. That's literally how they built their business. And I was like, oh my gosh, amazing, great salespeople. But it is an important question, because the communication of this in a way that feels like it's easy to get, even though it might not be easy to do, is part of, it's not a trick. It's part of how you get people to become willing to accept the ideas. Like they need to feel a proximity, like an ability to do them. And the visual can help make that happen. That's all I'm saying. You mentioned Hinge. And it sounds like you like what they're doing. What do you like about what they're doing?
I wrote recently about Hinge's new initiative to cure, so to say, the loneliness epidemic among Gen Z, and how they are essentially, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, putting millions of dollars to create these initiatives where they create spaces for socialization for young people who don't have, you know, third spaces to go to interact with one another. And they have found this social issue that is not directed to dating specifically and to the act of swiping on the app in search of a romantic partner, but is grounded in this broader human need for connection that is very relevant to the younger people who are using their product. And I like that as an example, because it is, to me, a kind of a response to critiques. Well, the mayonnaise cannot save the world, so, you know, why should dating app? And I think it's just a very smart example of finding a social cultural issue that feels very organic to the category and to the kind of needs, human needs, that are driving young people to use the app in the first place. And not only that, they're not just producing a marketing campaign and putting it out there. They're putting resources behind it and creating mental health resources for young people, directing them to spaces where they can learn more about how to connect, how to take care of themselves. So I've been following that example, and I'm really pleased with what they're doing.
Okay. And then Lyft, you mentioned, is doing good stuff too. What are they doing that you like?
Interesting one. Lyft's Women Plus program that is designed to match women and non-binary riders with drivers of their gender. And it's an interesting one because there is an acknowledgement from the brand that that's not always possible just by the nature of our sexist society, where drivers more often in taxis and Ubers and Lyfts are men. But when I was recently in New York for the book launch, I opened the app and was catching a Lyft, and it gave me a little notification that said, where possible, you can opt in to being matched with a female or non-binary driver. And to me, that's another example of speaking to social and cultural issues, not in a tacky, performative way, but actually listening to your customers and understanding their customer journey in relation to their identity. And, you know, being safe and making sure I get home at night has always been part of what it means to be a girl and later a woman in the world. That caught my attention. And even though the infrastructure is not perfect, as a customer, I felt seen and understood by the brand. And in my estimation, I think that's where the most powerful purpose-driven work, for lack of a better term, might lie for brands in the future.
First book, have you found your writer's voice?
I have. I, for the first time, included the word writer in my bio, which I think is still in my bio if I have not taken it on one of these days. But I think I have found that my academic voice has a place to exist in this corporate space and have been very pleased by their reception, which is writing is a lonely process. And it's something that you're thrown into by yourself, wrestling with your ideas and trying to stay true to yourself as an author, as a writer, while also communicating in a way that's legible and that's accessible. And so this book, I hope, is a start of me feeling more comfortable with my academic, long-winded, lengthy voice.
Connected to this is slightly abstract, this question. How did you experience yourself in the act of writing this book?
I just have to sigh in relief. It was honestly agonizing. I mean, on a very human note, I only had several months to write this book because when you are trying to get your foot in the door in this industry, you know, as a newcomer, so to say, from the world of academy, that's not very legible. You jump on any opportunity to do so. And I've had a pretty short, fast, and pretty successful entry into this profession. And so I received the book deal and I just had to get it done, you know, while working a full-time job. So the book is really born out of labor of love and sweat and tears, staying up, you know, at my desk until 4 a.m. in the morning on weekends with no weekends off. And that has been an experience. And part of it is that it allowed me to sit with my ideas and really put belief in them and then they actually matter in business, which is something that I struggle with is, you know, I think that these ideas really matter, but will the readers really see them in the same way? So it was a grueling process.
Again, a little build here. What did you find that you revealed to yourself about you in the process of writing this? A new or evolved relationship with yourself having gone through writing a book, which is a really big thing to do.
Well, part of it is, again, on a human moment, what I write about in the dedication of this book, which is that it is dedicated to my academic mentor. And I credit her with what I call self-regard, a sense of self-regard for one's ideas. I think that I come from academia where it is very hard to see yourself as a thinker, as a writer, and to really step into your ideas with confidence. And that's something that a lot of graduate students struggle with just because we are in such a rigorous experience for, you know, 6-7 years of our careers and being trained and critiqued incessantly. So I really confronted how writing and just a creative expression has such a direct relationship to one's self-esteem and to one's belief in oneself and being able to navigate self-doubt and, you know, things that honestly people don't see when I post on LinkedIn and when I'm very outspoken and activist-y, but I'm also human. And so it helped me to confront part of myself that are insecure, that are a little bit unsure about whether my ideas will be received and like still plow through. And one person when I was just starting out years ago, when we met, gave me the advice that has stayed with me, which is that you just need to put your imposter voice, for lack of a better term, into the corner long enough to get it done. And I felt that that's precisely what happened with the book. I just had to learn to keep that voice in the corner and get it done.
I relate, but I'm going to be a little bit more emotional. I think I learned how to love myself a bit better by writing a book in a way that I had not really experienced.
You might be getting me across that bridge closer towards you because I do relate to that.
Now you are, as the author of this book, responsible. You're the CMO of the book. You're responsible for the marketing of the book. How have you been thinking about getting attention for it? What have you been doing?
I try to lead with ideas and, you know, not necessarily market the book as a product, but leading with asking questions, really. I kind of alluded about what I'm thinking about in this moment, which is, you know, the attack on DEI, the way that the conversation around purpose is being reduced. And I'm just thinking about, well, what kind of question the book answers and how can it be helpful? And to be quite honest, I was sitting the other day at my desk and I was just like, oh, like I wish I wrote it completely differently, you know, with the knowledge that I have of what's happening in the world right now, with the kind of conversation that we are having. And so I'm trying to market the book with attention to the current conversations and what's mattering to my readers who are marketers, researchers, strategists, creatives, et cetera, in this particular moment. And I think that's how I maybe have a little bit of an academic way of thinking about a book project, but what intervention the book is making, that's really the question for me. And again, that's my academic baggage. I see the book not only as expression of my ideas, but as some kind of intervention that is looking to shake things up a little bit and answer some of the pressing questions. So leading with questions, leading with ideas, that is usually my MO.
I mean, there's a saying out there, I don't know who coined it, the best way to market a book is to write another book. And so the questions that you're having now, curious to watch what you do in the coming years, there could be a slightly pop culture version of what you're doing, where this book is like the thing you stand on, and then you maybe you break down soft guy era, soft girl era, whatever it is, and somehow connect it to the stuff that you take more seriously. I think that would be really useful and interesting and help you sort of flex this universe that you're creating. I know you don't want to be thinking about writing a second book.
I have, actually. That was my first thought. I was like, I can do this. I can do this again. I held the book and I was like, wow, I can do this. I can write, you know, I can put out things into the world. And that kind of unleashes the possibilities of like an excitement of what's coming next. So I am excited to work on the next thing. And I imagine it to be a little bit less wedded to marketing and advertising as a profession and a little bit more about culture. And I'm really fascinated by this question of speaking up and like, what does it take for people to not feel anxious, as anxious or shy away from some of the tough questions that we need to be answered, but how can we bring people along and make it more popular to ask unpopular questions? That's what's on my mind these days.
All right. Well, here's not a popular or unpopular question, but it's definitely coming out of nowhere. And it's the last question. How do you feel about Latvia?
How do I feel about Latvia? That's where I grew up. I feel longing for my homeland. I feel constant grief around being far away from home, which is part of my also immigrant experience. And I guess that informs the work that I do now. But Latvia is where my family is. And that's where home is. As you, I'm also navigating this experience of being, you know, an immigrant in this country, trying to make it, trying to make a mark, trying to climb the ladder. And so Latvia is always in the background of what I do. And, you know, I talk a lot about in my work about my grandfather. So I'm going to give him a shout out here, my late grandfather, who is actually pictured right there behind me on video. I guess most people won't see it. That is looking over me from the portrait behind me.
For anyone listening to this who's interested in the topic, or as a boss who's interested in the topic, it's a very broad topic, important topic. Culture Intelligence for Marketers is out now through Kogan Page. I think it's, what are you going to lose in reading the book, is my question to people connected. Why wouldn't you want people to have human rights? What's wrong with these things? I don't get it. I do think it's going to be an important book. I'm not just saying that for the sake of it. And I also think your second, third, fourth, and fifth books will be important too, for what that's worth. Not that I'm judging. I'm just trying to end dramatically and hyperbolically. Let's get people onto your Instagram. What's your handle?
My handle is my name. You can find me at Anastasia K. Gabriel. And as many people know, I'm also quite active on LinkedIn. So find me there as well.
Thank you for listening to my long paragraphs that had question marks at the end of them. I don't know whether you'd call them questions or confusions.
You might be anxious when I slide into your DMs or your comment section. I am anxious when Mark Pollard invites me back to the podcast, because I know it's going to be an interesting one. I'm glad I survived, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate your attention and time.
Absolutely. I look forward to book number two. Thank you for joining me here on Sweathead today.
Thank you, Mark.
Peace. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sweathead. If you enjoyed it, please share it with a friend, subscribe to our newsletter, find us on Instagram or LinkedIn at Sweathead. And if you're interested in finding out about our strategy, memberships, company training, or books, visit sweathead.com. Whoop, whoop.